Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Last Saturday's rally in Berkeley was advertised as a Patriots Day rally by the Liberty Revival Alliance, and it quickly turned violent. Most media coverage framed the fights as pro-Trump protesters clashing with anti-Trump protesters. But is that the way to assess what happened last weekend? Today's guest, Shane Bauer, was there. He found members of various white nationalist groups who traveled to Berkeley from around the country. Anti-fascists and anti-racists were also there. And things got ugly very quickly. 21 people were arrested as clashes, punching, and kicking broke out. And Shane was there taking photos and taking videos, and he wrote a piece for Mother Jones called "I Went Behind the Front Lines with the Far-Right Agitators Who Invaded Berkeley." Shane is an award-winning senior reporter at Mother Jones. Hi, Shane. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We are also joined by Wes Enzina. He's a senior editor and writer with Mother Jones, and his latest pieces are called "I Met the White Nationalist Who Says Trump Made Him Rough Up a Protester." He also wrote an interesting and very lengthy story about the rise and fall of a violent anti-racist group, providing a glimpse into an underground movement that's poised to explode in the Trump era. And you can find these stories, and I hope you read them over the weekend, at yourcallradio.org. And Wes joins us in studio. Hi. Wes. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Nice to be here.
And we were also going to be joined by Martin Shulaw, an award-winning Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. We were hoping to talk to Martin about coverage of Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan's narrow referendum victory and the alarming attacks on journalists and media organizations in Turkey. But Martin had an emergency. He had to travel to Iraq to write about what's happening there. So we're sorry we weren't able to have Martin join us, but hopefully we will have him join us in a couple of weeks. And then later in the show, we will be talking about Bill O'Reilly, who lost his job, the O'Reilly Factor, for which he was paid $75,000 per show on Fox News. This happened after a New York Times investigation found that five women received a total of $13 million from Bill O'Reilly or 21st Century Fox after accusing him of sexual harassment. And we're going to talk about how the media are reporting on O'Reilly's influence on the dialogue in this country later in the show. But as we always do on Your Call, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So Shane Bauer, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
You know, I read a really good piece yesterday in The Stranger by Ejioma Oluo. It was about Rachel Dolezal, called "The Heart of Whiteness." And I know we're all sick of hearing about Rachel Dolezal, but it was a really great interview that she did, and kind of, you know, explored and got into their interactions. I really recommend it.
And just remind us, who is Rachel Dolezal?
Rachel Dolezal is a white woman who identifies as Black. And there was a lot of controversy around her. I guess it was about a year ago now. And she recently just came out with a book, and she's since changed her name to Nkechi Amare Diallo. So she definitely has not backed off of her assertion that she's African American, even though she was born white.
All right, so kudos to The Stranger for that story, and we'll put links at yourcallradio.org. Shane Bauer is an award-winning senior reporter with Mother Jones. And Wes, what about you? What did you see this week that caught your eye?
I was catching up on some old reading, and I read a piece about a Idaho town that's sort of fashioning itself as an anti-sanctuary city. That was pretty fascinating. We've obviously heard a lot about some of the resistance coming from local municipalities, sanctuary cities, trying to figure out how to deal with Trump. This was sort of a counterexample of a town that's embracing what's happening on a national level and using city laws and municipal government to embrace that rather than reject it.
And what are they doing specifically to embrace it?
Mostly just passing, making it more difficult for it's sort of like a super version of having the police also doing the dual duty of immigration enforcement and applying this to, you know, everyone in this small town.
All right. Well, that is Wes Enzina. He's senior editor and writer at Mother Jones. And we will link to these stories that Wes and Shane talked about at yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive in now and talk about what happened last week in Berkeley, but also just reporting on white nationalists in general. And we already got a couple of emails about this. So if you want to join our conversation, what really struck you about the clashes that happened in Berkeley? Things got really violent. Shane Bauer was there, and he took videos of people really, I mean, going after each other, hardcore punches and kicking. And Shane interviewed and took photos of a lot of the white nationalists who were there, and a number of groups were there. So if you'd like to join us to talk about what you think about that coverage and just white nationalists in general, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. I have to admit, because we focus on healthcare and poverty and the climate, I have not spent that much time reading about this, but I did yesterday. And both of the reporting that you both have done is really kind of shocking, because I did not know that this was so pervasive. First of all, Shane, I also did not know that the Trump administration has taken white nationalist groups off the official U.S. terrorist list.
I wasn't aware of that either, actually.
Wes?
Sure. Well, there was a story that was a Reuters reporter had sources within inside the Trump administration that said that they were going to do this. So that's kind of where it remains now. But basically saying that they were going to prioritize so-called Islamic terrorism rather than domestic terrorism, including white supremacist groups like Timothy McVeigh. And there's an interesting quote from the editor-in-chief of the Daily Stormer, a white supremacist website, who says, yes, this is real life. Trump has set us free.
I was surprised that this hasn't gotten more attention.
Yeah, right now it... that's the story that leaked from these various sources is where it's at. So it hasn't officially been, isn't something that's officially happened. And maybe it's because of the response to that reporting that it wasn't pursued. But either way, the message that groups like various white nationalists and white supremacists, the message they hear is the same message they've been hearing since the beginning of Trump's campaign, which is that perhaps we're going to get a you're going to get a pass if you commit violence if you're on the far right. Whether or not Trump's saying that, I think, is impossible to really determine, or whether he's knowingly blowing on that dog whistle. But regardless, people are hearing that. And there was this case with Matthew Heimbach, a fairly well-known white supremacist, who's suing Trump Heimbach is a white supremacist who was at one of these rallies, one of the Trump rallies, and he was filmed pushing pretty aggressively this Black Lives Matter protester out of the event. And the woman sued Heimbach and sued another person, and also sued Trump for being assaulted. And Heimbach filed a countersuit saying Trump's responsible for whatever financial penalties are levied against me because he said, get him out of here, and even said in a previous rally that he would pay the legal fees. So it's funny, Heimbach is actually taking Trump at his word, which I think is a sort of paradigmatic of how many people on the far right are interpreting Trump's one aspect of Trump's message.
Shane, you were at the rally last weekend, and you met a number of white nationalists, and the Daily Beast also reported on this, and they named some of these groups. And some of these groups I've never heard of. The Proud Boys, this is a right-wing group that extols white chauvinism and has called for closing the borders. The Oath Keepers, a group of former military and police who have pledged to support gun rights. The founders of Identity Europa, a supremacy group dedicated to the idea of, quote, awakened Europeans. For people who are not following this very closely, tell us about some of these groups and how big are they?
I mean, their numbers are hard to say, but what was interesting about this event to me was the it was a real mix of groups on the far right. Some of them are overt white nationalist groups like Identity Europa. There's the Proud Boys, which are affiliated with the alt-right and have kind of become known as, you know, in this movement that largely exists online. They have come out to these events and are known for brawling. You know, they're often at the kind of front line of these events and ready to throw punches. And then, you know, then there's groups like the Three Percenters that were out there, which is a militia affiliated group. These are guys that do paramilitary training. I actually went undercover with them last year and did an operation on the U.S.-Mexico border, where they're out there, you know, with assault rifles, military gear, trying to find people entering the country. So, you know, they're now showing up at these protests and doing, you know, security. They were around the stage, essentially holding it, you know, defensively. And then the Oath Keepers are affiliated with Three Percenters, but they're veterans, typically, who, you know, are kind of have a kind of fundamentalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. And then, you know, there were a lot of groups out there, or people, individuals, who, you know, kind of are connected to this world through 4chan, you know, websites where some of these far-right individuals gather, but don't necessarily interact in real life. So that was one of the interesting elements of this, is that, you know, these groups that don't ever see each other are now all here thrown in together. So you have, like, these kind of paramilitary guys that are wearing camouflage, and then you have somebody holding a sign that is referencing an obscure internet meme that is very self-referential. Then you have, you know, actual people from that call themselves National Socialists, which is the Nazi party, doing Nazi salutes. And then there are, you know, a good amount of people of color with Make America Great Again hats on. And, you know, they're all mixed in together.
Hmm. You actually took photos of people doing Nazi salutes.
Right.
And Wes, what would you say, because this didn't just start with Trump. We're going to talk about the piece you wrote about anti-racists who believe that liberals are not up to the challenge of beating back right-wing extremists. And this didn't start with Trump.
No. What the anti-fascist movement, if you want to call it that, has its origins in the 1930s with the rise of fascism in Europe. The most notorious incident was something called the Battle of Cable Street in 1936, when, and according to some accounts, as many as 100,000 people, I think the real number was more like 20,000, basically of anarchists, communists, Jewish people, confronted Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists in the streets in London's East End, and they just brawled. There were thousands of anti-fascists, and there were a much smaller number of Mosley's men, and they chased them off, beat them with chair legs, dumped chamber pots on their heads. So, you know, it's basically the anti-fascist movement begins with the rise of fascism in Europe. And then in America, the kind of first notable incident of this conflict was in 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina, when a group organizes something called Kill the Klan Day. It's a rally to protest the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. And suddenly, as people are rallying on the street, Klan members and neo-Nazis show up and open fire, and they kill five people. And that, I think, has a sort of mythological status, understandably, for people on the militant left in the U.S., especially people who imagine themselves as anti-fascists or anti-racists. In 1983, you have a group called the Baldies, which sort of take a nod from the skinhead culture in Europe, which itself, both fascist, it was conflicted over being anti-racist or racist. Anyway, the Baldies are a street gang. They're a multiracial street gang that beats up neo-Nazis. And the Baldies give way in the in 1988 to a group called Anti-Racist Action, which was a group committed to confronting white supremacists using what they call direct action, which means they don't rely on legislative mechanisms, they don't rely on protests. They actually physically confront white supremacists and refuse to allow them to organize in the case of the origins of ARI in Minneapolis was where the Baldies were from and where ARI had a big chapter in Ohio. And so from the 80s until basically for the last 25 years, these conflicts have been bubbling up between various groups on the far right, whether they're white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the whole grab bag of far right groups have been fighting with Anti-Racist Action and groups affiliated with them, and there have been brawls, there have been stabbings. And my article talks about an incident in 2012 when a group from based mostly out of central Indiana called the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement, which was sort of a local chapter of Anti-Racist Action, they 18 people show up at a diner in a little suburb of Chicago because they've been tipped off that there's going to be a white supremacist meeting in there, and they burst through the door one morning and just start pummeling these white supremacists with nunchucks, with knives, with although no one was actually stabbed, but people were armed with knives. But yeah, they start beating people with nunchucks, with clubs, with batons, with chair legs, and five of them were caught as they were trying to get away and went to prison. And so my article tells the story of these five people. I interviewed one of them in prison, and they didn't give interviews to the press because much of what they do is illegal, so they tend not to want to talk to the press.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And we'll talk about some of the people that you interviewed who, when they were younger, really could have gone either way. A lot of these young men were kind of lost, and they could have gone the white nationalist way or the anti-racist way. And it's so interesting to read that they were heavily influenced by Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow book.
It's a little mind-blowing to think that people could be potentially persuaded by extreme racism or by this very militant anti-racist ideology. But I think it makes sense if you understand the context of who these people are. So my story tells the story of three brothers, the Sutherland brothers, and one of their cousins, and then a fifth guy who was just sort of a friend. And they're working class guys from Indiana. The Sutherlands have a black half sister, so obviously that makes them sort of, it's understandable why they would be viscerally enraged by racism. But yeah, how could they be persuaded either way, or how could they be tempted to go either way? And I think, which is Alex Stuck, who's one of the people who was imprisoned for this attack, the youngest one, he said explicitly, he told me, thank God that HARM, the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement, thank God they got to me first, because I could have gone either way. And he calls himself a muggle after Harry Potter, someone who didn't know, before he knew about anti-racist ideology, he was someone who didn't understand the magic of anti-racism. But I think the way they can go either way, or the crucial factor there, is that in this instance, it's largely working class, disaffected young men. I don't think that's necessarily true of the sort of the anti-fascist movement nationally, but this particular group were very much rooted in Indiana's working class.
Yeah.
And so they, the far right offers an explanation for their disenfranchisement, which is that the liberal political, the institutions of liberal political governance you're competing with it for jobs. Basically, the far right says you're competing for jobs with immigrants, with minorities, and it's the programs that redistribute wealth that are the explanation for your poverty, for your feeling alienated, and which has its echoes in the populism of Trump and the nativism of Trump. And then the militant anti-racism on the far left says, no, actually, that's all a smokescreen to get us to not notice that the rich fat cats at the top are actually dividing us, dividing minority workers and white workers, and if as long as we're fighting each other, we're not going to focus on them. And you know, it also has its echoes. It's exactly what the Occupy movement was saying, and it's interesting because the people who went to prison in my story were part of Occupy, and they actually felt frustrated because it seemed ineffectual.
The anti-racists
were involved, but they also talk about how there were white supremacists coming to Occupy in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. Peddling their message, saying, you know, it's the Jew bankers who have caused this crisis, which, you know, there's an equivalent, not in terms of the Jew bankers, but in Steve Bannon, who, you know, if you watch any of his films, Generation Zero, for example, he's making this argument that it's the bankers, of whom he's one or was one, obviously, who have caused this crisis. And so it's basically both arguments are critiques in a way of capitalism, and that's something that we forget about the far right is that at least in its most, you know, the neo-Nazis and white supremacists and the Klan have largely a critique of capitalism. It's just also a racist critique of capitalism. And I think
Shane.
Oh no, when I it just makes me think of when I was at this demonstration on Saturday, there's a man named Kyle Chapman who's kind of a rising figure in the Bay Area kind of far right scene. He's really known for being a street fighter. He's known as his nickname is Based Stickman. He got that name after an image went viral of him hitting an anti-fascist protester in the head with a stick. And he gave a speech on Saturday. And one of the things he said is that, you know, he said Americans are under assault, and this assault comes from all directions: the mainstream media, corrupt government officials, crony capitalism, and our education system, which indoctrinates our youth. Now, you could imagine some leftists saying the same thing, you know, But these guys, you know, are, it's like people on both sides in some ways have there's a good amount of overlap in their kind of gripes. But they have a very different approach, you know, where the left is kind of, you know, forming, it doesn't have these kind of leader figures. It's more dispersed and horizontal, and the right takes a kind of sees a solution in kind of authoritarianism. I saw something really similar with the militias, where, you know, a lot of these individuals were, some of the things they complained about were, you know, some, they would get wrapped up in kind of conspiracy theories that were totally illegitimate, like that the United Nations was going to invade and take their guns away. But then there were things, you know, real issues like the overreach of the NSA, the kind of, you know, surveillance, growing surveillance state. They would talk about Edward Snowden. You know, so I could imagine them having gone either way as well, like Wes is saying. And for some reason, I don't know if it's that, you know, this is the group they came upon first that kind of laid out, you know, a path for them and some potential answers or a way forward, so that, you know, it's kind of random which way they went, or, you know, what's pulling them in either direction. It's really fascinating.
Can you talk about, Shane, how they've been emboldened by Donald Trump?
Sure. I mean Saturday was the official call for this rally was that it was a free speech rally. But there were, you know, many people with Donald Trump flags. Many people were saying that they were there to support Donald Trump. And, you know, these groups, we did not hear about most of these groups before the election. And a lot of these groups we didn't hear about before Trump became president. There's no doubt that they are emboldened by Trump. I mean, even on social media, I mean, I remember the day that Trump got elected, I start getting people messaging me on Twitter who had bios that said KKK or some various neo-Nazi group. That never happened to me before. That was regular, daily. Hmm. And, you know, emails, stuff like that. And then, you know, having these groups not only come out visibly, you know, off the internet, but to specifically target a place that they see as a liberal bastion like Berkeley, that's never happened before, as far as I know. I mean, this is pretty unprecedented.
Shane Bauer is an award-winning senior reporter at Mother Jones, and his latest piece is called I Went Behind the Front Lines with the Far-Right Agitators Who Invaded Berkeley. Here's what I saw when white supremacists, Trump fans, and other factions clashed. We're also joined by Wes Enzina, senior editor and writer with Mother Jones. He wrote a lengthy piece about the rise and fall of a violent anti-racist group, which provides a glimpse into an underground movement that's poised to explode in the Trump era. It's our media roundtable, and we are talking about media coverage of white nationalists, anti-racists, anti-fascists, and last Saturday's rally in Berkeley. It was advertised as a Patriots Day rally by a group called the Liberty Revival Alliance. It quickly turned violent. 21 people were arrested. Shane Bauer took video and photos of clashes, punching, and kicking. And so many in the media reported that it was a clash between anti-Trump supporters and pro-Trump supporters. And so we're going to talk about how these fights and these clashes are framed in the media. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, you can call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. Let us know if you are a first-time caller, because we always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will be joined by Timothy Walker, author of Teach Like Finland, 33 Simple Strategies for Joyful Classrooms. We'll be talking about what education is like in Finland. It gets a lot of attention here in the United States, and so we thought it would be a good idea to actually talk about the differences. That's on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're talking about coverage of white nationalist groups with Shane Bauer, an award-winning senior reporter with Mother Jones, and Wes Enzina, senior editor and writer with Mother Jones. And then a little later in the show, we will talk about media coverage of Bill O'Reilly losing his $75,000 per show job on Fox News. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about coverage of last weekend's violent clashes in Berkeley, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Edwin in El Cerrito. Hi, Edwin. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm Edwin Rutsch, director of the Center for Building a Culture of Empathy, and we actually had set up an empathy tent there at the demonstration at 9 a.m. So we had about 10 to 12 listeners, people offering empathic listening and dialogue and mediation there. And we also had some of our group actually walking around through the crowd. We actually went and offered empathy kisses, so they're little Hershey's kisses to both sides. We gave hugs. I probably hugged about 20 people on both sides. And when the event first started, we actually went up to the pro-Trump side and talked with them a bit, and they were actually willing to offer us a space to actually give a pitch for the empathy tent, that their members could come and be heard at the tent. So my real question, I guess, would be, why don't groups that offer, you know, like a positive message or trying to do conflict mediation, why don't they get more coverage in the media? And maybe secondary to that, too, is couldn't reporters and the media be more like mediators, that they would maybe have some mediation skills? So instead of just analyzing, maybe reporting on the event, that they could actually foster connection and dialogue between the different groups.
Well, thank you, Edwin. I did read about your empathy camp in a couple of articles. Shane, you briefly mentioned it in your piece.
Yeah, I think that this empathy tent, to me, was one of the most symbolic parts of this day, because when I saw it, it was entirely empty. There were hundreds of people there, and you know, it seemed that was certainly not the feeling of the day, that there was any empathy going around from one side to the other. I mean, I kind of stepped away from an ongoing brawl that was just endless to drink some water and saw this empathy tent, and there was no one there.
What are your thoughts, Wes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the imperative of reporting on this rise in violence among the far right and anti-fascist or anti-racist groups is necessary for journalists because they're new, and no one really understands what they're about and who they are, where they come from. So for me, at least, the motivation is to do that work, and they're there whether we report on them or not. And so I think it may be an unpleasant truth that these groups are there, but they are. So I think it's important to really dive in and figure out who they are.
And we can go ahead, Shane.
Oh, I think it's important also for people to understand that this is the latest in a series of events. There's really been three events that seem to be related, starting with the Milo Yiannopoulos talk on UC Berkeley campus, which was disrupted by hundreds of protesters, including a good number of anti-fascist protesters. And then there was a rally in Berkeley last month that was kind of a pro-Trump rally. It was a lot of the same people that were there on Saturday. But, you know, each of these, they're becoming more and more violent. Mm. So it seems to be that there is an escalation going on, if this continues, I will not be at all surprised if somebody is seriously injured.
Wow.
And also what is happening is that there are figures that are becoming more and more known on both sides. Both sides are filming the entire time. Journalists are filming. There's so much material online. And it's being dissected, and, you know, people are identifying leaders of these different groups. Nathan D'Amigo, for example, who's the head of Identity Europa, a video went viral of him punching a woman in the face. You know, the next time this happens, if he is there, a lot more people are going to know who he is and recognize him than did last time, which is why you see also more and more people on both sides wearing masks. This is something that anti-fascists have done for a long time, but the kind of left-wing side of this event, we're not all anti-fascists, but people are, you know, wearing masks also on the right-wing side because of this kind of dynamic where everybody's filming and then people are being targeted. And, you know, their identities are getting put out there, and they're feeling that they're at risk. So, you know, it just seems that there's a lot more at stake each time one of these events happens.
In terms of the escalation of violence, too, just piggybacking on that, I mean, on January 20th at the University of Washington, a anti-fascist protester during a Milo talk was shot by a member of the alt-right and a Trump supporter. And, you know, this weekend in Pikesville, Kentucky, there's probably going to be another one of these clashes brewing. It's led by a traditionalist youth party, which is run by Matthew Heimbach, a sort of well-known white supremacist in the National Socialist Movement in the League of the South. And there's a call out now for anti-fascists to meet them there. The thing about Kentucky is it's an open carry state. And
oh, wow.
So people... it's also a stand your ground state. So people are anticipating that, you know, who knows what could happen here. But certainly people will be armed, and that's, you know, that's this weekend. So again, as Shane was saying, this is I wouldn't be surprised either if it continues to escalate.
What do you think, Shane, about how this was framed in the media? The LA Times had a piece called "For Many at Violent Berkeley Rally, It Wasn't Really About Trump or Free Speech. They Came to Make Trouble." And then in the story, Paige St. John writes, "What appeared to be a political event devolved into violence and was actually something more complex. The combatants on both sides were extremists who traveled from far and wide to make Berkeley their stage."
Yeah, I think the battle over framing has really been interesting. Some who wrote about it from afar did frame it as a pro versus anti-Trump rally, which I think was mistaken. I think there were elements of the far right side that came essentially to support Trump, but that was only one group of among many. The right wing side was framing it as a free speech rally. Essentially, they're trying to reclaim what Berkeley is known for from the 1960s, its free speech movement, which was a civil rights movement, and they're trying to kind of use that framing to have the right to talk about whatever they want, even if it's how, you know, white people are genetically superior to everyone else. The opposing side, I think, saw that free speech framework and the Trump framework as a kind of cover for white supremacist groups to gather in Berkeley. But I also think there is some legitimacy to the take that you mentioned, that, you know, there is a dynamic where these groups are both showing up to fight each other. I mean, the anti-fascist side is saying it's showing up to, you know, because this can't be allowed. It can't be allowed for white supremacist groups to openly parade in the Bay Area. But both sides are coming up geared up. The right wing side had helmets, goggles, the left wing side was masked up and ready to go. And as soon as I got there at 10:30 in the morning, there was a front line, and they're shouting at each other across riot police. I would have been very shocked if it hadn't turned violent.
Why wasn't there more police intervention, Shane? You interviewed a few police.
Yeah, that was an interesting dynamic, and I think actually on the last rally a month ago it was similar, where the police essentially just backed off. In the very beginning they had a pretty strong presence. They had the whole park cordoned off, and people had to enter through one entrance and had their backpack searched. Anything that could be used as a weapon was confiscated, or in my case, I had a water bottle, a metal water bottle. I had to leave that outside. And they were essentially standing in between the two sides in riot gear with tear gas. But shortly, when the first brawl broke out, someone from the left-wing side had thrown an M80 to the other side, and then the right-wing side rushed in, and there was just a brawl in the park. And the police slowly moved in, and then I heard one of the guys on the right-wing side kind of command his people to fall back, so they all came back. And then there was one or two other brawls that the police were around for, and then they vanished. I mean, I didn't see them for 2 hours. I didn't see the riot police. I saw some police on rooftops filming. They kind of disappeared, and I don't know what the thinking was there. I interviewed some later that I saw parked a block away and asked them, you know, why they were hanging back, and they essentially just told me I need to talk to their, public information officer. But I've lived in the Bay Area for a long time, for about 20 years, and I've seen, many waves of protests come and go. I've seen the police strategies change, and this does seem to be a kind of a new approach that they're taking, where they used to kind of just come in and sweep everyone up. You know, they would surround the crowd, load them on buses, and take them to the jail and release them. And now it's much more about surveillance. You know, they're filming people, they seem to be building cases, and then they come and arrest people later. Hmm.
Shane Bauer is an award-winning senior reporter with Mother Jones, and Wes Enzena is a senior editor and writer with Mother Jones. It's our media roundtable, and I just lost my internet connection, so if you can join us on the phone, that would be great. 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Gina in Fremont. Hi, Gina. Welcome to the show. Hi,
Hello.
Gina. Hi, Gina. You're on the air.
Yeah, I can't help but notice it's usually men fighting other men. I don't know how many women contributed to this, but I just remind you we're in a patriarchy. And so, you know, men head up the organizations, men do the fighting. You know, I'm sick of it, basically. You know?
Yeah.
I'm real sick of it.
Yeah, violence. I hear you. We're going to talk about Bill O'Reilly because that's also related in a couple minutes. Shane, there were a few women at the rally. In fact, one young woman got punched really hard. You were talking to us earlier about Benjamin D'Amigo. There was video of a young woman getting hit very hard by this guy.
Yeah, I mean, there were women on both sides. I would say there were a lot more women on the left-wing side. On the right-wing side, there were some kind of figureheads. Lauren Southern was one, who's a kind of alt-right-affiliated writer. She was there. She actually was being had an entourage of guards from the Proud Boys. There was another woman from alt-right.com who kind of spreads the conspiracy theory of white genocide. And then on the left-wing side, you know, there were women. I didn't really spend much time on the left-wing side, but as far as I could see, you know, during these clashes, there were groups of women that were there, but definitely the vast majority of people fighting were men. And it was a very, I would say, a very kind of macho atmosphere. I mean, I would notice individuals of men on each side focusing two people would be kind of focusing on each other and kind of challenging each other until a brawl would break out, and then they would go at it. It was a pretty testosterone heavy event, I would say.
Wes, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a presence, a small presence of women in the anti-fascist movement. Ostensibly, it sort of includes not only a critique of racism, but also a critique of sexism and homophobia. For instance, my introduction to anti-fascist groups was actually at a party, incidentally, when I was in college. And there was a guy telling a story, and he was a member of Anti-Racist Action in Philadelphia. And this man called him a faggot at a bar, and he was telling the story to a group of people. And the guy, he said, you know, he took the guy outside and beat him unconscious and was kicking him in the head. But the anti-racist action member was gay, and as he's kicking him in the head, he's telling the story, and he says, "How does it feel to get beaten by a faggot?" So, I mean, I think the reality is it is a very machismo-driven culture, and on the far left, I think there's actually an undercurrent of them trying to present this sort of counter model of masculinity that is both anti-racist and embodies more progressive values, but combined with probably a pretty toxic masculinity.
Well, thank you for calling, Gina. Let's go next to Marcus in Oakland. Hi, Marcus. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Just following up on the police response that you were discussing earlier. It's Going Down, which is a anarchist-leaning blog, ran an article a couple of days ago that reported that Trump rally organizers had met with the police ahead of time to discuss, even though it wasn't a permitted rally, that the police still gave them a meeting and sort of talked about how they could, quote-unquote, protect them. I wonder, Shane, if you had noticed the police showing preference to one side or the other, and if you think that this meeting that they had with the Trump organizers affected that.
Shane?
You know, I couldn't tell, I mean, honestly, which, if they were favoring one side. I definitely noticed that the protesters on the right-wing side had assumed that the police were on their side. When what I think was the first person arrested on the right-wing side. I believe he was a Proud Boy, but I might be mistaken about that. I overheard one of them say to another person, why did they arrest one of our guys? And then the speeches that were being given on stage, you know, kind of far back from the clashes, many of them started with thanking the police. Kyle Chapman said he congratulated the police for not running from Antifa. His narrative was that they had fled in the last rally because they were afraid of Antifa, and now they're taking a stand against them. So they definitely seem to see the police as being on their side, which, you know, would never be the narrative on the anti-fascist side.
And again, Antifa are anti-fascist. The Proud Boys are proud white chauvinists. I just want to make mm-hmm. that clear, because I know a lot of people have probably never heard of some of these groups before. Thank you for calling in, Marcus. And let's go to Tom in Oakland. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. When I saw the video, it was very disturbing and alarming. And I don't think these groups represent, I don't know about the Trump side, but as far as the anti-fascist side, I consider myself anti-fascist, and I don't see the violence on the street representing what I stand for. And we have, you know, there's an intellectual vacuum that this represents, the coarsening of the inability to think and dialogue, and the tendency to demonize the opposite side in the same way the Trump campaign demonized Muslims, minorities, Hispanics as a way to get into the White House, even though there is a legitimate, in my opinion, critique of capitalism coming from the traditional Midwestern Rust Belt states, which needs to be discussed. And I have friends and family members that voted for Trump, and I vehemently argue with them. But we have to use argumentation. And this lack of dialogue and thinking is going to lead us down a slippery slope.
Well, thank you, Tom. We'll definitely continue to cover this and focus on this. Thank you for your call. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I've lived around here for a while, and I've been to several protests against right-wing groups, some sort of Nazi group that wanted to march in Union Square. Then there was skinheads in Hill and the Hate. I even went to a protest at Ku Klux Klan rally in Austin, Texas. And I've never seen this particular a gathering like this, of this particular big, skinny, mean, violent guys in ever really in one place all organized like that. But they had to bring them from far away, you know, from as far away as Colorado, and we don't know where else. And I think that's play out where a lot of, there's a whole group of Latino Trump supporters. I'd like to know where they were from, if they were from one group, etc.
Yeah,
they had to truck them in from far away, so they're still a minority, but it still is a political moment where they feel like they're on the rise, so it is important to be there.
Well, thank you, David, and you're right, because when some of the videos that Shane posted, I had to watch them several times because they are so incredibly violent. I mean, you're almost thinking you're watching some sort of movie. Shane, what about that? When you interviewed people on the white nationalist Trump side, did you ask them where they were from, and do you feel like they were being honest with you?
I did ask them. I met a guy who came in from Colorado. A lot of people from all over California. A lot came up from LA. There's one Latino man who was going around saying Latinos for Trump, and he was from LA. There was an African-American man that I interviewed who came up from LA, and then people from Orange County, kind of all over the state. I interviewed a militia affiliate, and he said that they had brought people in from around the country as well. I was not interviewing people on the other side, so I don't know, you know, how many of them came from elsewhere. But I think it's a good point that David made, that people, I would say that the right-wing side slightly outnumbered the left-wing side there on Saturday. but they certainly weren't people from the Bay Area. I mean, they're kind of Berkeley has become a symbol for them, and they're bringing people in to kind of make a statement that they can take it over there, and you know they can give their message and they can't be stopped. You know, possibly the next one of these events on the frontier is Ann Coulter's speech at Berkeley. I don't know of any organizing that's happening around that, but I would be very surprised if there weren't clashes around that event.
Well, here's the latest news about that. So UC Berkeley canceled the event over safety concerns and then quickly reversed itself, saying it would reschedule the event. The Washington Post is now reporting that Ann Coulter is rejecting an offer to reschedule. She says she cannot make the new date.
She's
accusing the university of trying to replace restrictions on her free speech.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see, you know, how when these people come, like Milo comes or these groups come, you know, and the left side is kind of saying, you know, this is not the place for you. We're not going to allow people to come into the Bay Area to kind of spread hate speech. So we're going to take a stand against it. And, you know, the right wing narrative is, you know, we're going to the city to speak, and the left is against free speech, so they're shutting us down. And then it's very easy to come in to a place like Berkeley and then kind of turn it into a victim narrative, which I think, you know, is part of the story.
Hey, we're going to have to do a whole show on this because there's so much interest. And just quickly, we didn't have time to talk about Bill O'Reilly, but the fact that Bill O'Reilly lost his job making $75,000 per show, he's been on the air for many, many years. We're talking about toxic culture. Not only, you know, so many women accused him of sexual harassment, and the New York Times reported that five women received $13 million. But over the years, he said so many racist things. He calls blacks cocaine dealers, says the slaves who built the White House were all fed. Wes, what really struck me, and just quickly, there's a lot of attention on the sexual harassment, and these brave women went on MSNBC last night to talk about that, but not much on Bill O'Reilly's racist comments over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think O'Reilly's popularity and his success was itself a symptom of the breakdown of civil discourse and the polarization of the left and the right in America, and that we see now playing out in a more extreme way, two sides that have really nothing to say. There's no dialogue between them. And I think fascists and anti-fascists and their way they're fighting everywhere is a symptom of the larger political breakdown.
Wes Anzena is a senior editor and writer at the Mother Jones, and Shane Bauer is an award-winning senior reporter with Mother Jones, and you can find their pieces at yourcallradio.org. Wes and Shane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.
Bill O'Reilly was